World War II was getting underway, and Mother had moved into town and was working at the studio. Gerard was working for that engineering firm in Fort Worth and was busy running all over the world, building airports for the Army. You three younger boys were in college at A&M. We were busy and didn't get around much, but slowly we did make friends and build our new life. One friend was a bit unusual, one Bob McGlamory. Nice guy about Gerard's age and a grad from Texas University at Austin. He was single, and as the editor of our local weekly newspaper, he was a very busy young man. At that time, I made quite a lot of pictures for the newspaper, and in this manner, I came in contact with him. Being away from home, I think he was a bit lonesome. He published on Thursdays. So on late Wednesday, he would put his paper to bed, and Thursdays, he would relax a bit. Now where? At the studio, of course. Every Thursday morning, he would show up early, usually with a big bag of peanuts, but sometimes apples or other fruit. Mother would have a few cookies and make a pot of coffee, and we had a nice coffee clatch. Bob, being from Texas and you boys from A&M, there was often a lot of good-natured joshing going on, especially as the football season warmed up. He liked to talk football, but recognized the fact that I wasn't a dyed-in-the-wool foot fan. Once I made a brash statement that over half the people who attended our local high school games knew nothing about the game. I offered to bet him if he'd go out on the street and as a roving reporter and asked the first 10 people some very simple football questions, he would be surprised at the answers. So we made the bet. He would ask of each interviewer, "Do you like football and attend the games?" If they answered no, his interview was over and that one didn't count. If the answer was yes, he went on with the questions. I don't recall all these questions, but they began with how to score the game, penalties, offsides, and so forth. All the easy ones. Reluctantly, he went out on the street and was gone about an hour. Back he dragged, looking about like a whipped puppy, and slunk into his chair. "Mr. D, I never would have believed it. It was worse than you pictured it." And as Thanksgiving came closer, Bob's interest deepened, and one day he insisted that I ought to go to one of the A&M Texas games, just one, anyhow. "Well, Bob, what for? You know I'm not a big fan. It'd be a lot of trouble to go, and what did I get out of it?" "Well, I think you'd be interested in observing the other fans, how they react and respond to the excitement of the game. Bob, you really think I'd enjoy that? Mr. D, I really think you would. I urge you to go sometime." At this, your mother, who had been quietly listening, chimed in, "That ain't no compliment." So Bob got to go to the game and came home full of football. Texas had won because he was there to root. But not too long after that came Bob's turn to answer the Army's call. And in turn, all four of you boys had to answer that same call. And in time, you all straggled back one at a time. But Bob finally landed in Kingsville and was the editor of their paper. Eventually, he married a widow who had lost her husband in an airplane accident. And we did keep in touch for a time, but that lapsed. You three younger boys returned to college, and again football became important in our conversation. Again Thanksgiving approached, and this time the game was to be played in Austin. You boys came up with a wonderful idea. You would get the tickets to the game. Mother and I, along with Gerard and Julie, would drive to Austin and meet you there, and we would all get to see the game. So I was finally following Bob's idea. All worked out fine, except that we all didn't get to sit together. But that didn't matter. This was no time to visit. It was a fine sunny afternoon, and we had wonderful seats on the west side of the field, right in the center and up high, where you could see everything. Oh, yeah. It was quite exciting, as Bob had promised. The show they put on, bands marching and so forth. Even the people around us were interesting. One young couple sitting in front of us, the girl directly in front of me, I couldn't understand why they wasted their time coming to the game. He couldn't keep his hands off of her, and she was so willing. But, of course, this was pre-game time, and I assumed he would give up and watch the game after it got underway. I was almost right, but it took him till the last few seconds of the game to give the playing his fullest attention. Even I had to concede it was a good game and fairly even, but to this day I can't tell you who won. It really was an enjoyable afternoon, and the crowd did not disappoint me. They had started getting a bit unruly towards the end, and the score was tight. They screamed and they yelled, and everybody got up on their feet and stood up, excepting me. Then the sky blew up and something happened down on the field to our left, close to the edge. Nobody could see, even standing up, so everybody stood up in their seats so they could scream and yell louder. Except me. I did stand up, though. I was afraid I'd be stepped on if I stayed sitting. They yelled, hollered, and screamed. And this fool boy with a little girl in front of me, he just went hog wild. He was screaming at the top of his voice, his arms stretched straight out to his sides, and he was flailing in like a windmill. His right arm came around in a circle, and he hit that little girl right in the chest and knocked her over backwards out of her seat. Luckily, I was standing on the floor observing, so all I had to do was hold out my arms and cradle her gently as she fell. I don't know who was the more surprised. She lay contentedly in my arms and looked up at me with those big soulful eyes and said, "My, it's nice that you're so strong." Gently I put her on her feet and helped her back to her place, standing beside her guy up in her seat. He hadn't even missed her. I had always thought this would be a good story to tell Bob, but I never saw him, and time passed. Several years later came another football season to remind me, so I sat down and told Bob all about it. He would have appreciated it, but just about the time he should have gotten my letter, he was the victim of a hit-and-run driver. We had a city election a couple of weeks ago, and you might be surprised to know I voted for a colored lady as a city alderman. She isn't real dark, had more schooling than I ever had, and certainly can use better English. She knows music. Her husband has sung in the Baptist church, and Mother and I were invited to be there as guests. He was my barber for a number of years. I had met them at Tetley's little church when Tetley was first starting. This causes me to ponder over the changes that have come to pass over the years. Today I had a call for some undelivered pictures, and while I was hunting for them, I ran across a brown envelope. Inside the brown envelope was a copy picture of a Negro woman. On the envelope was one word, Shorty. This goes back to the early 30s and the Depression. Shorty was probably in his late 20s, a stocky but short, and everybody's friend. I don't know how or where he lived. One day he showed up at the studio with a photo to be copied. It was of his mother who had died, and the only picture existing of her. He had to return it. We made the copy, and he came and looked at it. I handed it to him, and he looked at it with tears in his eyes. He reached in his pocket and paid me, gave the picture another long look, and handed it back. "No, Shorty, this is your picture. You've paid for it." "No, no, Mr. Lobrecht, you keep it. You take care of it. I'll always know where it's at." And he turned and left. I wonder where Shorty is today. Back there in those early 30s, our town was small. Everyone knew where everybody else, relied more on each other for companionship than today. Main Street was short, and the corner where the combination hotel, bus station, filling station stood was where the action was. run by a character named Dennison. One time he had me photograph the place. A good sharp shot, including several loafers draped over the pumps. He paid me, then added, "Lobrecht, this is my fault, but I didn't tell you I wanted no people in the picture." "Do you think it'd be possible to do that?" "Sure, might take a couple of trials." I picked the slackest, hottest part of the afternoon, and everyone inside out of the sun. Using the Grayflex, I went down and made quite a display of picking my position, focusing, pulling the slide in my holder, went all through the motions, and those loafers spied me and took up their positions again. I went through the whole rigmarole and carefully noted just where I stood, waved goodbye to the loafers, and went on down the street and turned into Goodwear's shop. Watching till the coast was clear, I hurried back to my spot and hurriedly made my shot. Dennison was disgusted when I went to deliver. He saw me go through the motions the first time, but didn't see the repeat. Both he and the loafers never could understand why they weren't in the picture. My explanation was I just left them off. Of an evening, this hotel corner was a busy place. Everybody met here, particularly the adults and the county sheriff and his cohorts from the courthouse. Remember, there was no fast food joints for the youth to gather around, but this corner also had a restaurant and a drugstore with a soda fountain, and just a half a block down the street was our only movie house. The teenagers were just getting a good start driving up and down Main Street and, of course, had to pass this corner. There was a pair of teenage girls had a new Dodge Coupe, and it was the proud boast they had 5,000 miles on the car and never been off Main Street. Always something doing. One evening, a couple of older boys bet $10 they could drive to San Diego, purchase a quart of whiskey, and be back at the hotel in 21 minutes. They didn't make it. Had a wreck coming just at the edge of town. Most of you will remember the old Falfurrias Highway, runs south right alongside the railroad tracks. Also, this little creek of ours, a couple of blocks north of our house. This creek wanders to the west and crosses the Falfurrias Highway about 6 blocks or so north, south of the hotel. Most of the colored people live in this neighborhood at that time. They had built a nice little church on the banks of the creek. And, like many churches, particularly Baptist, they had their protracted meetings. And, of course, in the summer, hot weather, all the doors and windows are open. The program attracts attention, and the word gets around fast. These older teenagers, quick to take advantage of a new divertisement, would drive by to see what all the shouting was about. Now the colored congregation knew it would be difficult for them to complain about these white kids to the authorities, so they put up with the nuisance of their visits at first. But with each successive visit, the white kids took more liberties and were more obnoxious. It got to where they would climb up and sit in the windows and catcall to each other across the church. Wisecrack about the congregation, and the white kids thought they were getting away with it. They were superior. The Negroes figured out a solution without calling on the whites. One night, the white boys were unusually rough, and just as the minister started to preach, he was interrupted. Then the fun began. A riot broke out down front center of the church. Two Negro men were in violent and loud dispute. They called each other bad names and started to fight, but instead both drew guns and started shooting. The women all screamed. Trouble was, both guns always seemed to be pointed at a window, and those window watchers didn't even wait to climb down from their perches. They just fell out on the ground and made for their cars, rushed down to town and the hotel where the sheriff was loping. "Mr. Charlie, there's shooting going on down at that church, and they're killing people." "Yes? What were you boys doing down there?" "Now, you boys just sit here till I get back, and we'll go see what's going on." So Mr. Charlie drove down to the church and quietly stepped up to the door. Everything was serene and in quiet order. The service proceeding quite normally. The preacher was a little perturbed to see Mr. Charlie at the door, but Mr. Charlie just gave him a wave of his hand and turned and walked away. He returned to the hotel to see and told the kids to stay away from that church and not go near it. Those kids had a hard time living down the reports of their part in the story. How were they to know those shots were all blanks? Back a ways, I mentioned the movie theater, which was a magnet for all ages. The queerest were that bevy of older teenagers with nothing else to do, and the challenge being there, they made a game of crashing the gate, sneaking into the movies without paying. They got pretty good at it, but the manager and his ticket taker quickly learned who the crashers were and were too watchful. But one of the boys figured out a brand new way. Five of them pitched in a nickel each, which brought the planner an entrance ticket and a bag of popcorn. The agreement was that they had to pull off this coup while the manager was relieving the ticket taker, and this would add to the spice of the event. So the group idled out in the street till a small group of patrons entered to file past the manager. It would take this operation several seconds for him to greet each one in turn and accept the ticket stubs. So this crasher timed himself to quickly edge past this group just as they started. He made it, but the manager saw him and recognized him. And he went clear down to the front of the theater where he never sat and made himself as small as possible. Just as soon as he was free, that manager was on his trail and found him and was going to throw him out, but the guy objected. "But I bought a ticket. Didn't I give it to you?" Then started searching his pockets and finally came up with it and handed it over. All this took several seconds, and while this was going on, the five outside hurried in and passed the unguarded door and scattered all over the place. Then when the show was over, the manager stood there watching and saw this whole group leaving. He realized he had been a sucker, but it was too late. He had been had. Today I saw a pair of mockingbirds, and I do hope they will stay with us. Did any of you ever see a mockingbird fight a cat? Now there is an unequal struggle that takes the cake. No cat is the match for a couple of determined mockers. The first time I saw it, I could hardly believe my eyes. This was while Mom was still with us in the little house next door. Mom had a big cat that we suspected of dining regularly on unsuspecting birds. Two pairs of mockingbirds built nests in the trees of our backyards and managed to evade the cat until it came close time for the little ones to leave the nest. And both the cat and the mama birds were alert. Every time the cat would casually trot across the yard, all four birds would dive bomb the cat, and the poor cat, completely at a loss, would crouch, which was a mistake. Then they would dive at the cat from different directions and snatch wisps of hair out of the cat's back. The cat had no defense, so would finally make a break for the house. Then the birds would set up a watch, and if the cat would come out on the screen porch, they would land in those banana trees and scream and cuss the cat till he went back into the house. Only time the cat dared come out of doors was in the dark of night. They kept that program up until the young birds could fly and left the home nest. The other night, Evelyn and I were talking of baking and the changes in practices. As a kid in Mount Pulaski, you couldn't buy bread in a grocery store. As I recall, that practice was started about World War I years. Almost all families did their own baking, and all flour had much more of the wheat left in it than is the practice today. Even a small town would have a bakery. Bread cost 5 cents a loaf, 6 loaves for a quarter. Bread was not wrapped in individual loaves as today. At the counter, your order was dropped into a sack or wrapped in a piece of white paper so you could carry it home. Most bakeries bake two kinds of bread, white and graham, which was a whole wheat bread, and sometimes would add rye bread to the list. At Mount Pulaski, the bakery was operated by a big German named Charlie I. Here in Alice is another German named Gummert. Their operations were quite similar. One thing about their setup fascinated me, the ovens. Both were different, similar. Built of brick, including the firebox, the oven about the size of a large dining table with cast iron doors. The roof of the oven was a flat dome. I don't remember that roof to be over 2 feet high in the center of the dome. This dome was also brick, of course. They had contraptions like big paddles with long handles to put the pans where they wanted them in the ovens. They easily slid these paddles under the pans at any time they wished to change their positions or withdraw them from the ovens. These oven floors were about chest high to the average man, so it was more convenient to operate the paddles. Nancy, if I understood you correctly, some time back you expressed concern because one of your little ones was not very outgoing with her friendliness. You know, I once knew another little girl who had that same difficulty. Her name was Nancy and was my first little granddaughter. Every time I could offer her any attention, she would cry. If I walked over to admire her as she lay in her mother's arms, she would screw up her face and let out a yowl. She kept this up one solid year. Then came the magic day, and ever since then I've been her patsy. You were living in Tremont at that time. Mother and I had been to the farm and stopped by on our way home. Everybody was in a dither and busy. You were unhappy, too. I went over and took you from your mother, telling her if you were going to cry anyhow, I might as well be in my arms. So I took you right out of doors. This took you off guard, but you stayed stiff and rigid. We walked around, and I sang to you. We admired the flowers. And a neighboring puppy dog came by for a little attention. And gradually, you relaxed in my arms, but not one bit of a smile. We must have been outside about 20 minutes or so, and it was getting time for us to leave. The whole family had gathered out in front where the car was standing. You were quiet, and I walked over to your mother and tenderly placed you in her arms and started getting in my car. You looked up and realized I was leaving. You objected. You straightened up stiff, held out both arms to me, and let out a big whack. And that was the beginning of our understanding. Another time later, you were living in Oklahoma, a nice sunny winter day, and you were unhappy. Also, it was time for a nap, and most certainly you didn't wish to go to sleep. So again I bundled you up and took you outside, and we walked around and wound up at the swing. You wanted to swing, and it was lots of fun, but after a time you got a little quiet. You looked a little limp, so I quit pushing and quickly got around in front where I could see your face, and I was just in time. As you swung forward, you just pitched right out of that seat, and I caught you in my arms. You didn't even wake up. Took you into the house, and your mother fixed you up in bed, and you had a nice long nap. And you have been my little girl ever since. I miss seeing you and your little ones. Anybody want a cannibal sandwich? Of all things, here they are, in polite society again. Recall the stir they made when you all were little kids? I sure was surprised at your mother that she could feed you anything as wild as that. But apparently you liked them and thrived on them. Evelyn had introduced them to little Amy, and they were a success. But like me, Walter was caught a little bit off balance. I got a care package last night. Tonner went to the Golden Age dance in Corpus, and they served strawberry shortcake for lunch. One of the fine ladies fixed up one of them for him to bring home to me. Then today, Jim was over and invited us to come over and pick blackberries. We got a nice big pan full, and this would have to happen while Gerard and Evelyn were not here. Mrs. Heldenfels from Beeville was here yesterday also. She brought us a nice sack of vegetables out of her garden and all stuff we didn't have. The cucumbers were especially good. She reports Kathleen and Christy will be home for a visit in the middle of June. Morris, unable to get away, so his visit will be later in the year. When Morris was a little boy here, some way he acquired the innards of an old hand-crank telephone. It had no crank, but the kids could manage to turn the wheels enough so they would get a mild electric shock. They had a lot of fun with it, so I took the contraption down to the Lynn Brothers machine shop, which was across the alley behind the studio. Showed it to Bill Lynn and told him the kids needed a hand crank on it and could he do it for us. Bill looked at it and drew a long breath. Yes, he could do it, but he wasn't interested. Cost too much. Bill, you got grandkids, haven't you? Yes. Well, if you went to the store to buy them a present, you'd pick something that would built right and would last. What would you expect to pay for it? Bill, I'm not asking you for a two-bit job. Well, if you put going to talk that way, I see your point. Come back tomorrow. The neatest little brass hand-turned handle on his big lathe, and I think he was a little proud of his job. Now, you kids really did play with it. Morris took it to school for a show and tell. I went back to Bill and reported its success, and the idea pleased him. I forgot to mention he charged me $3.50. Alfred asks for a list of the trees that we had since we came to Texas, and now this gets complicated. Here in town, these are the trees we've got growing around the yard here. The native trees, live oak, water oak, mesquite, magnolia, ebony, wild olive, anakawa, retama, two kinds of elms, cedar or river elms, weesach, hackberry, pecan, or the little pecans, very young, the juniper, javencillo. Now the exotic stuff, that is the stuff that aren't native here, Japanese varnish tree, arborvita, bamboo, sour orange, loquat, China berry, two varieties of China berry, the regular China berry and the umbrella China berry, fig, peach, pine, two or three kinds of palms growing around, all just starting, the peepal tree, eucalyptus, avocado, mulberry, podocarpus, and various kinds of cactus, and the athol. All of the above are trees we now have growing in our yard here in town. There are a few of them that are still quite small, but plenty are quite large. For instance, that huge live oak that Mother started from a sprig not over a foot tall in a tree. It is now a tree about 40 feet high, and its trunk measures 58 inches in circumference, 3 feet above ground level. The bamboo Morris started as a small boy now dwarfs the tallest utility power poles and is a patch about 30 feet circle, so thick you can't hardly squeeze through it. The mesquites are our pride and joy, but the magnolia has never really adapted to this climate. It is not much of a success. All of the native trees thrive, and all the exotics mentioned above have done very well. For instance, the eucalyptus is our tallest tree. It is a massive thing and very frost-resistant, but it suffered heavily in the last winter's record freeze. Cacti also suffered from that freeze. The wild olive is now filled with its big white blooms, and the figs are setting on, but still will be short crop on account of the freeze. Our peach tree is small and over age, but it's doing very good. Evelyn gathered the first ripe peach yesterday. A number of the native trees, particularly the anakawa, are full of little berries just ripening, and the birds love them. Also, the birds are very promiscuous about planting these seeds just any place. The seed all grow. The retama, with its lacy leaves and beautiful yellow flower, is in full bloom right now. The varnish tree, with its big leaves, will be in full bloom in a day or so. The athol, mentioned last, does not belong there. We have no athol, but there is a fine big tree that I planted on one of the vacant lots next to us and then sold the lot. You might wonder why we bother with a sour orange. Mother always had a healthy respect for this tree and its fruit, claimed it was higher in vitamin C than any other citrus fruit, and she preferred it to lemons for flavoring. So we grow a sour orange, and now Evelyn gladly uses up its fruit. The following are trees we tried growing here in town but gave up on. The tepawahi, the ash, jacaranda, cottonwood, willow, olive, tallow, banana, apple, jujube, papaya, ailanthus. You might remember that one as the tree that grows in Brooklyn. The paper mulberry and all sweet citrus. Various reasons for giving up on these. Most of them were subject to the webworm. This has been a bad year for that affliction. On this list are normally bushes or underbrush out on the range, but raised under different circumstances, they may surprise you and make small trees as well as bushes. Now growing in our yard here in town, our rattle bean normally grows in lagoons. We've got a small tree here. The wild olive, we have both tree and bush. The mountain laurel, we have both tree and bush. This produces the red seeds the necklaces were made from. Sunisa, beautiful blooms after each time it rains. Coyotea, Mexican persimmon, Arizona pepper, and Brazilian pepper. The bougainvillea, this will make a small tree, but usually vines. Pomegranate, ours is a very large bush, beautiful red blooms. Cassia, orchid tree, schefflera, oleander, vitex. Brasil and granjeño, both of these seldom make a tree, are usually a part of the heavy underbrush. Got stickers and makes yellow berries. The Mexicans eat them. And then the pear tree. Following are trees and bushes we had on the farm. The rattle beans, anacawa, hackberry, brasil, willow, pomegranates, oleander, pear, various cacti, mesquite, retama, sunisa, granjeño, chinaberry, crepe myrtle, athol, apple, ebony, weisach, pecan, mountain ash, fig, mulberry, bananas, wild olive, mountain laurel, coyotea, Mexican persimmon, peach, jujube, various palm trees, and all types of citrus. Probably the one tree that was most imported into this country and made the greatest impact was the athol, of course, and we had a hand in it. It has been touted to us by the county agents and so forth as a must for a windbreaker for the citrus. It proved to be most effective. Originally came from the Mediterranean to Arizona. Something new. Several of us at Fremont got together and ordered 1,000 cuttings. From them came all the athols you see all over the south end of Texas. Now I have taken Gerard as my authority for all of this listings. If any of you disagree in any way, don't bring your troubles to me. He is your victim. This is another of my old letters to Ariel. There has always been lots of deer and deer hunting in this country, also many, many deer hunting tails. In our early years here, it wasn't uncommon to see deer crossing the road as you were driving through any ranch country, and officially there was a deer hunting season, but that was for the outsiders who would all have to have a license anyway. Most of the venison we ate on the farm was prime meat and butchered in the off-season when the hunter's family needed meat. Situated as we were, hemmed in on two sides by large ranches, we were bound to be aware of this practice, and although we never did such hunting, we were frequently presented a nice care package of fresh veal. I personally have never been deer hunting. Time goes by, and in the past years, changes have been taking place through this country. Nearly all of the good hunting lands are now rigidly patrolled all year and then leased out to the general public for the privilege. Some leases are to clubs or organizations for the season. Many of them sold the privilege at so much per day to the general public. The hunting has been good all through this South Country this year, so we drew hunters from all over the country. Late one afternoon, an oil man from Oklahoma turned up at one of these camps west of Fremont and announced he had come after his deer. The keeper registered him according to law and answered him, stating that the deer was there. All he had to do was go out and get it. Hell no, man. I wouldn't walk through that brush for all the deer that are out there. All I want's just one of them. See to it that it's here by morning. With that, he threw the keeper a $10 bill and went on inside the camp. He peeled off his hunting clothes and proceeded to join an all-night poker game that was in progress. The next morning, he stumbled out into the early morning sunlight, rubbing his eyes, and there, over the limb of a mesquite tree, hung his deer, all nicely clean. A grin spread over his face as he hollered for all of the gang to come out and see. Look here, boys, see what I got. Isn't he a dandy? He made no bones about it, but donned his hunting clothes, then loaded the buck on the front end of his car, and gaily started for home. I'll bet he had some tall tales to tell when he got there. Here's one for you boys. You sung them with much gusto. In the shade of the old apple tree, I was chased by a big bumblebee. I lit out and run like a son of a gun, but the bumblebee, he followed me. With my hands I covered my face, but he lit in a much worse place. The place where he lit, I'm just able to sit in the shade of the old apple tree. There is such a multiplicity of breakfast cereals in the market today that you wonder where it all comes from. It wasn't always so. I can't remember when we didn't have oatmeal, cornmeal, and grits, nor did we have others, but some bright soul thought otherwise and dreamed up an entirely different one and dubbed it Multivita. Today, they are just ordinary cornflakes. I was a very small boy at that time, and since then, the list has constantly grown. Go back to about the time of World War I. I was in the studio at Mount Pulaski, and my best buddy was Virgil Conley, a clerk in his brother-in-law's drugstore. Now, this wasn't like today's modern establishment, but the old-fashioned country-style store like you read about and occasionally see on television. But it was what we were used to. Didn't even have the modern conveniences, a soda fountain. The front part of the store, one side had all school supplies and so forth. The other side, a cigar and tobacco counter, then their brushes, toothbrushes and so forth, and other prepared medications, tonics, salves and so forth. The back half was solid with adhesives. Solid with shelves and space for the prescription department. These long shelves were filled with glass jars and other containers. In them were all sorts of herbs, roots, dried leaves, and so forth. Some we recognized, but mostly they were utter strangers. The back of the store, utter comfort, a grand place to loaf. Big windows open and let in the southern breeze to cool you in the summertime, and in the winter a huge heating stove with bars to put your feet up on. Comfortable armchairs and usually friendly companions. I was a regular, of course, and several other loafers, but one of the finest was an elderly retired Dr. Nolan. He was a fine, friendly man, on the reserve side, but he was good to listen to. I should have listened a bit more to him. One day he was reading the paper, and all of a sudden he exploded. How gullible we ordinary citizens were, especially in buying our foodstuffs. We insist on it being put up with sugar and spice and everything nice and then put on the grocer's shelf. Put an ad in the paper telling us how nice it was and we'd all run to buy it. After he'd cooled down a bit, somebody asked him what the explosion was all about. He answered someone had brought out another new manufactured breakfast food. The world didn't need it. The Lord had already given us the ideal perfect breakfast food. It was grown there on our farms, available to everyone, contained all the essential properties our bodies needed, and was cheaper than anything else we could eat. What was it? Whole grain wheat. To prepare, all you had to do was wash it and put it in a pot with water and boil it slowly until thoroughly cooked, then eat it as you would oatmeal. The perfect food. What he didn't add was it also had the roughage they now stress. His message reached deaf ears, as far as I was concerned. Wheat was a good chicken feed and could also be ground into flour, but that's about all. Now jump 25 years up to World War II in Texas. Jim Smith had a friend, Gail Hines, who had just lost his job in the oil fields. His company had been sold, and he was too old to enter into the new company's insurance program, so he had been let out. He was kind of panicky, for at his age, good jobs were scarce. But he solved his troubles by opening a Dr. Fix-It shop. He was handy with tools and a success in this venture. One day I dropped into his shop and he was unpacking a box of tin cans. Looked more like grocery items, and I asked him what he had. He tossed me one of the cans and added, "Here, look this over. Would be good for you." What was it? The same product Dr. Nolan had touted years ago, only this time put up commercially. He gave me a couple of cans. Try. We liked it. It was good. But a second time, I failed to come up to scratch. Now jump another generation to the present time. First, Tarj comes up with that oat coats or hulled oats. Cooks like oatmeal. Very good. No chance to pass this up, for he feeds it to me daily, and I would miss it. Then Gerard shows up with a container of whole grain wheat. He buys it from the Mormons. Evelyn cooks it like Dr. Nolan instructed, and we all enjoy it. They even cook it in the pudding sometimes, like your mother used to make with rice. Use cinnamon, raisins, and milk. Look how long it's taken for me to get educated. This Dr. Nolan had a lot of ideas that weren't quite general, a lot of them on diets. He had a small place out in the creek used for a summer camp, and he went out there very often, about 3 miles, and of course he walked the distance and carried a lunch for his usual fare. His wife fixed up his lunch, which was the usual fare, with a nice piece of pie or cake placed on top so it would get squashed. One day the good doctor took along a friend, both equipped with the usual lunch. The doctor spouted off about this next day in the drugstore. The day went fine till they stopped for lunch. The other guy looked on so astonished when Nolan started in on his dessert first and enjoyed it very much. He stopped the good doctor, telling him it wasn't good manners to eat your dessert first. He answered, "Manners, fooey. When does manners come before health?" The time to eat your dessert is first, when all your glands and taste buds are in their peak of performance, and you enjoy it to the utmost. And as this particularly takes care of your appetite, you won't overeat on the regular fare of beans and potatoes. You'll eat your fill and give the rest to the dog. But start in on the regular fare first. It tastes so good, you fill up to the brim. And then there's that dessert left. You can't pass it up, so you pack it in on top, and then you get the bellyache. Back in the 30s, here at Alice, I had a fine friend from Falfurrias named Alejo de la Garza, Alex to you. At that time, he was working in San Diego. He was quite a camera bug with hopes of becoming a photographer someday. We had many student sessions, and he credited me with teaching him quite a bit. Later, he did open a studio in Falfurrias and seemed successful. At this time, Falfurrias was larger than when I tried it. Alex went home frequently, and one Christmas week, he went home for a hunting trip and collected this story. The De La Garza Ranch, in common with most all of the land in Texas where the hunting is good, is posted and in charge of a game warden who lives on the place and watches over it. Sort of a caretaker. One day when he was in town, a hunter from the north was directed to him and stated he was there in hopes of going on a hunting trip for turkeys. He had been told there were plenty of turkeys around Falfurrias, especially in this live oak territory. The gamekeeper had been recommended, and could he help him out? Even went so far as to promise him $10 if this keeper would take him to where he could kill a turkey. In fact, he'd give him $10 for each and every turkey that he bagged on the trip. This Mexican keeper hesitated a bit and then assured this northern hunter that he had come to the right man. But they couldn't go right then because he was busy, and besides, it wasn't the right time of day. The time to hunt turkeys was early morning, just at the break of day. So he had this hunter go to a motel and get a little rest, and he promised to come and get him at the proper hour. Came the evening, and the Mexican keeper went home. And after dark, he went out to his domestic or tame turkey roost and took five of these tame turkeys in a box. He went out into the brush about a couple of miles to a place he knew well, where he placed these tame turkeys to roost on the limb of a low mesquite tree. He knew they would remain there the rest of the night. And along before daylight, he went and woke up the hunter and insisted they had to start right away, and took the hunter over to the place in the dark and he trailed the hunter all over the place in the dark. And with the first peep of dawn in the east, they reached the chosen spot. The keeper stopped him. "Shh, can't you hear those toms?" And the fellow's imagination let him hear them. He cocked his gun, and the keeper had a hard time restraining him from rushing in. Pointed direction. Stealthily they crept up closer till the keeper could with difficulty point out the turkeys on the roost, just starting to wake up and stretch. At this point, the keeper really had a time restraining the hunter. You see, the keeper didn't know just how good a shot this intrepid hunter was and didn't want any chance to miss. At least he wanted to get that $10. Finally, they reached a spot where a miss looked impossible, and with the signal, the hunter raised his gun and opened fire. His gun was an automatic, and he emptied it in one continuous roar. The din in the early morning was tremendous. Five very bewildered turkeys bit the dust. Happiness reigned supreme. The proud hunter beamed all over ear to ear, and he could hardly contain his joy as he forked over the $50. He draped his five turkeys over his car and headed for the north and home. Now, those five turkeys were far over the limit had they been wild, but no game warden stopped him, and he jubilantly drove through towns and waved to the hoi polloi. And while the joke was on the hunter, that keeper has undergone a lot of ribbing over the price he sold his turkeys for. The market price for turkeys at that time was $1.25 to $1.50 for each dressed. Now, some of you might question this story, saying wild and tame turkeys should readily be distinguished. Probably so in any other country, but South Texas. In our early years here, the Mexicans had turkeys that looked a whole lot like wild ones, undoubtedly crosses. Many times the wild ones would come up to the ranches and entice the tame ones to follow them. Remember, we lost a fine gobbler that way at the farm. It has been written, to reminisce is to show age. If this be true, I have sure showed myself up in this whole endeavor. Ariel contributes the following from a letter of mine of years ago. I guess Morris age at about 14 or maybe 15. Alicia said he was younger. Morris thinks he's a little special in this world. Really fancies himself as a gourmet, although he would never state it in those terms. He thinks he has been raised on perfect pies to hear him speak his piece, and his life with us has been a serious drought in that respect. Remember, he has lived more than half his life with us, and Emma admits to no ability in the art of pie-making. Being appreciative of fine viands, it naturally follows that he is an unusually fine cook within his field, to hear him tell it. So the other day, Mother needled him when he was going on about pie or the lack of it. So she really gigged him into baking a pie, his first and son's experience or instructions. No cookbook could tell him anything. Those books were written for women. Well, he did finish his job, and it must have been a struggle. When he finished, he had the whole kitchen in a mess. The tabletop, all over the floor, every pot and pan in the kitchen piled onto a dirty sink. Even the wastebasket. Alicia adds, Mother gave one gasp and headed for the studio. Morris hunted up a ball game. Eventually, Alicia got there and viewed the mess and threw both hands into the air. But she did have the mess cleaned up by the time we got home at noon. Mrs. Lobrecht, what in the world ever happened? You never had anything like this happen before. But she was good-humored about it, and to our astonishment, the pie was edible. However, he was through. We tried to buck him up and help him. I told him one on Grandma Hughes, my grandmother. She baked a pie every day. This was hard for Morris to believe. The pie was cut in 4 pieces. Grandmother got 1 piece. At noon, Uncle Will got 1 piece of hot pie for dessert. At supper, he had another piece, leaving the 4th piece early next morning. On his way to the kitchen to the barn, he would pick up this pie and nibble on it as he went to his chores. Now, to Morris, that routine was solid. Convinced he came from good stock, he felt better about the whole deal and tried baking a second time. Better yet. So yesterday he made his 3rd attempt, and still better. Quite candidly, he mentioned to me he had mastered the situation. Remember my telling you about your mother spoiling Gerard by cutting off the whole top of a freshly baked loaf of bread just so he could have a crust? History has been repeated. Evelyn bakes the most wonderful bread, and we all enjoy it. She uses flour that Gerard mills from wheat that he buys from the Mormons, using Tonner's mill. It's a wonderful bread, and there is always the usual grab for those crispy crusts. Last week, Evelyn pulled a new one on us. While she was rolling out her loaves of dough and filling the bread pans, she reached into the closet and got out Mother's old cookie tin. Then she took some bread dough and rolled out a flat piece about a half an inch thick to fit that cookie tin. I thought, uh-oh, we're going to have a pizza. But she set this tin up to rise like the loaves, and when ready, slipped it into the oven. It came out in time for supper, and we all had our fill of the most wonderful crusts. It was just thick enough to slice in two pieces, each piece yielding no two crusts. Talk about living high. I mentioned slicing it. No, no, I'm in error. You pick it up in your hands with hot pads and break it like New Orleans style. One day, your mother came home in a bit of a dither. She had been to town and stopped by to see Mrs. Heichel about something. The Heichels were getting ready to take a little trip, a vacation to Dallas, and of course she was full of the flurry of leaving. As your mother started home, Mrs. Heichel looked down at little Doherty asleep on the seat cushion. She looked at Mother and said, "You know, if you and Mr. Robert didn't have so many children, maybe you could make a trip like this, too." Your mother answered to me, "I wonder if she thinks I would trade places with her." And you know how that answer made me feel. During these earlier days in Fremont, we all helped each other to a much greater extent than would be done today. There was a time life presented problems to the Evans family, and gladly we helped to the extent that we could. We didn't miss the few eggs and milk we took to them, along with the occasional vegetables when available. Grace more than paid that all back in caring for Mother at the time of Doherty's birth. But in getting off the subject, it generally fell to my lot to take these little care packages to the Evans in town on mornings when I went after the mail. Ben was just a new baby, and Mrs. Evans was busy. Alan was not at home. Grace had a high school girl helping her and living in so she could attend school. Grace acted as her tutor at times. One morning I got there, and it was just one of those days, everything going awry. And it was almost school time, and this girl didn't have her lesson, and Grace had been unable to give her the time. So I was asked to do the honors and help the girl out. She was having trouble with a grammar lesson. She was prone to use words that she didn't know the meaning of nor could spell, and I made the preposterous statement to her that she should never use a word in conversation nor write unless she could both define and spell it. She looked at me in utter disbelief and asked me, "You mean to say you can do that?" And I assured her I could, and as the lesson was over, I gathered up my packages and started home. Afterwards, Grace told me, as you went out of the door, she turned to me big-eyed and said, "Gosh, ain't he educated?" And I've had a hard time living that down. If I used a word of more than two syllables, Grace would spout that at me. Back a ways, I told you of going to Decatur to see the big Ringling Circus. I failed to explain how such a kid was allowed to make that trip. Dad's brother, Henry, was a musician and played in the big circus band. And as a circus passed through Mount Pulaski on the way to Decatur, Uncle Henry stopped off to visit us briefly and arranged my trip. He sort of looked after me. Mother had lots of problems down there on the farm. One of the problems was getting you boys to the barber for their haircuts. There was nothing wrong about having your hair cut, but that chore was always something that could be put off until day after tomorrow. But Mother had a bright idea. We knew Barney Finley, the local barber, quite well, so she made him responsible for the haircuts. He saw you every day in town, and all he had to do was collar you, and if it needed cutting, drag you inside and give you a haircut. Only took a few minutes and worked out fine. The next day, Mother would stop in and pay, and the system still works, only now Evelyn is the prompter and the executioner. Works well. Ariel writes and reminds me of the racetrack at Mount Pulaski. She asks where it was at, just two blocks north of where we lived in a big field. Recall the block in front of us was a pasture. Then facing that pasture were a couple of houses, then fields to the east. The last house over there was occupied by a family named Bartles. The last, later, by another family, I forget their names, but they were very friendly, had girls about you girls' ages. In both cases, I was always welcome to come over and go through their place down to the back fence and slip through. Once in, I was quickly lost in the crowd and got to see nearly all the race meets and the baseball games. And it was not uncommon on any beautiful evening when out riding, if you passed by there, to turn in and ride around the track. We did it a number of times, and each time old Charlie always seemed to pick up a little of the spirit of the place and snap up and quicken his pace. Ariel recalls the night we went to pick up Esther at a party. It was about 11:30 p.m. and a lovely night. Mom was in her nightgown and ready for bed, but you girls talked her into going along. Nobody'd know the difference. And that night we turned in and went around the track, a first for Mom. And she insisted, wouldn't it be awful if we had an accident like a runaway and people came and found her riding around in her nightie? But old Charlie behaved well and delivered us back home all safe and sound. Ariel also reminds me of this oldie Dad used to sing to us. She also recalled something I likely was too young to remember. Dad would sit in the biggest rocker we had, and all four of us would pile on. I don't know how he was able to hold us all. Ariel claims we broke the chair down with such heavy rocking, and Mom called a halt to the practice. Here's one Dad used to sing to us. There is no place like home, sweet home, but I'm afraid to go home in the dark. Every day the newspapers say there's robbery in the park. So I sit all alone in the YMCA and sing just like a lark. There is no place like home, sweet home, but I'm afraid to go home in the dark.